people are setting out in these open boats, and that's important to keep in mind, evoking longship. There's no below decks. There's no captain's cabin. You're just exposed to the elements, exposed to the wind and the weather, rowing and sailing your way hundreds of miles, hoping that there'll be something of interest on the other side of the horizon. It's an incredible, incredible human feat.
You are listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke.
So we have with us on the line today the author of The Viking Heart, How Scandinavians Conquered the World. His name is Arthur Herman. Let's talk about the Vikings. And the key to your book is trying to make that bridge between who they were and who they are. But let's start with who they were, which is, you know, a little bit gruesome, right?
Well, as you said, you know, the book starts with the Vikings, but actually, in order to really understand who they were and why they were,
let's go back to the Fólkaflokkurin.
Yeah, you really, or even earlier than that, you really have to go back to the Stone Age.
Oh, come on. We don't have time to start in the Stone Age.
Well, the important point is that the people who the Stone Age hunters who moved into the Scandinavian peninsula, right, including Denmark and Norway and Sweden, are still the people who are there.
Right.
It's not an environment that tends to attract
people leave, but they don't come.
People leave, but they don't want to go there. They sort of think, I'll think I'll move somewhere else. So you're right. On the one hand, you had what's called the Iron Age in Scandinavia. You have the tribes who moved out from particularly southern Scandinavia, which means really the Danish peninsula, but also from Sweden, who then moved into the mainstream of European civilization on the borders of the Roman Empire.
When you realize how many of these influential tribes during the period of the decline and fall of Rome, how many of these tribes that caused it all were from Denmark or one particular part of Sweden, right?
That's right. The Goths in particular, you know, we, as a medieval historian, you always learn about and talk about the Visigoths versus the Ostrogoths, the two different wings as they descended into Europe. But the term Goth comes from the goats, which are one of the branches of the Swedish ethnic community. They're the names of almost all of those Germanic tribes that we know today, with one or two exceptions. Most of them reflect their original Scandinavian home.
Right. And these tribes, the Goths, the Visigoths, and the Ostrogoths, they came down into the Danube area. They swept into Italy. They swept into Spain. The Franks basically took over France and the Low Countries. And then, of course, the Germanic tribes themselves. And all of these came from what is now Scandinavia.
And probably the most famous for a lot of our listeners are the other two tribes, the Angles and the Saxons, who crossed over the North Sea to clear out the Roman Britain of its inhabitants and to establish their own settlements there. And, of course, later on they'll become tempting prey for their cousins, if you like, namely the other Scandinavians, Norwegians and Danes, who come as Vikings. So what's interesting about this is it's an environment in which people are constantly sort of moving away from, if not permanently, then temporarily. And if we want to understand the Viking episode in history, I think that's one of the things we have to keep in mind, Eric, is that this is a land in which when spring comes, you move. You try and get out of there in order to go collect the things you'll need to survive through the winter, especially if you take them willingly or unwillingly from your neighbors. The other aspect of it is the sea. You know, the word Viking, which really is a verb, to go Viking, meant in Old Norse, refers to people who do set out as marauders, as pirates, as we would say. But they've also, at the same time, too, this is the word Vik means creek. It means a river. These are communities which have built their lives around and are totally comfortable with the environment of being surrounded by water, whether it's lakes and rivers or whether it's the seas, and then ultimately, of course, the Atlantic Ocean as they reach out right, as they reach out across to the west.
So if you want to get out of there and it's spring and you're comfortable with the ocean, then it's kind of obvious what your move is.
I think it is. And we also have to remember how risky that was, too, that probably for every three longships of young men, and as we now know, young women who accompanied them, set out from their homes in Sweden, Norway, and Denmark to go prey upon their neighbors. Probably one-third never came back, either lost at sea or lost in battle and were wiped out. It was a risky venture. But the community understood how important it was, how important these voyages were, because it allowed the community to get the kinds of commodities, in many cases finished goods, from other from the more advanced peoples around you, particularly in Europe, and to bring those back home where those that kind of wealth was sorely needed. And at first it began, as I explained in the book, really, you know, these are the Vikings we always think about, right, from the TV series, you know, marauders, raiders, and pillagers. But it also inevitably became routes of trade and commerce, of doing business with your neighbors instead of, you know, pillaging them.
And then immigration.
And then immigration, because what the Vikings found was that these neighbors to their west and to their south, and then also even to their east in Russia, had in abundance the thing that was most lacking in Scandinavia, and that's arable land, where you could build a farm, feed a family, give your sons and daughters property after you die, the things you only dreamed about back home. If you came from a poor family or even a middling family, these things were available in abundance.
Yeah. So let's do a quick map of where the Vikings, I mean, we've got to start with Russia.
Russia's the one that drew particularly the Swedish adventurers, partly because of proximity, of course. You know, they basically slipped across the, you know, the Gulf, the Baltic or the Gulf of Finland, and you're there. You were able to find your way through the river courses that I explain in the book. That was really the key to the Swedish conquest of Russia, but also for the Vikings elsewhere. Was, you know, seagoing, they were fantastic at seagoing, but they were also really good at navigating rivers. And the shallow draft on their longships gave them this ability to travel deep inland along river.
Yeah,
courses.
Some of the, I mean, what are we talking about there? Like one and a half, 2 feet of draft? Is that, some of these are ridiculous.
That is correct. That is correct.
Which means you can go, I mean, like, Viking means creek. I mean, you could almost go into a creek with something that shallow.
You really could. And, of course, the fact that you have this, you're not only relying on sail power, but rowing power means that you can go backwards and forwards.
Or if you're going downriver and you want to go home, you don't have to rely on sails. You just row your way back up.
That's exactly. And then, too, the Viking ships are light enough, are built in construction so that, if necessary, your crew can disembark, pick it up and portage till you find a river.
That just blows my mind that they would portage. And I know that there was one case you tell about where with the siege of Paris, where they got blocked in and they just picked up their boats and left.
That's right. I mean, it's an incredible mobility that they gained through the longships, which totally stumped and baffled their opponents, because they could land anywhere, go anywhere, and then leave before, you know, before their opponents were able to pull together enough troops and enough military force to try and drive them away. They have this amazing, I call it shock and awe, but I think it's a pretty appropriate term in describing what the Vikings were like in their initial raids and initial forays in Europe, not just in Eastern Europe, of course, down through the river courses to the Black Sea, all the way to Constantinople.
Okay, so to draw the map, when you say down through the river courses, what you're saying is they go across the Baltic, they go into the river systems in Russia, and then they go down through those massive rivers in Russia into the Black Sea and all the way to Constantinople.
Yeah, that's right. And then eventually able to extending their trading routes all the way to Baghdad.
Right.
And in the west, of course, you've got them sailing west across the North Sea to the British Isles, Scotland, Ireland, the Faroe Islands, to Iceland, And then Greenland, which becomes a major trading post for the triangular trade between Greenland, Iceland, and Norway.
And then briefly, Vinland.
And then for a short period of time, it seems, landing on the North American coast to probably harvest timber, probably do some trade with the native tribes there, but not an extensive connection in any kind of way, and eventually those settlements get abandoned. In the end, the settlements in Greenland also get left behind. But the very fact that people are setting out in these open boats, and that's important to keep in mind, evoking longship, there's no below decks, there's no captain's cabin. You're there with everybody else, exposed to the elements, exposed to the wind and the weather, rowing and sailing your way hundreds of miles, hoping that there'll be something of interest on the other side of the horizon. It's an incredible, incredible human feat.
Yeah, it's actually kind of the closest kinship to it has to be the Polynesians.
I think so, and in the case of the Polynesians, I think we don't really know how many of those exploratory, you know, voyages were followed up by large scale, you know, settlement like the Vikings did with Iceland. But yeah, I think that's probably it. But of course, sailing across the Pacific, which is a feat in itself, but sailing across the North Atlantic with the storms, the ice, the shifting weather and currents, it's an incredible, incredible achievement.
Okay, so we need to position some people here. Rus in Russia stands for, what does it mean?
The men who row.
It means rowers in Old Norse, right?
Yeah, and so the men who row are actually invited to help sort out the political chaos among the different Slavic tribes there. This is in the 9th century, in the 840s, 860s. And in the process, they build two mighty Viking bases that become cities. One is Novgorod, and the other one is Kiev. And those become the core for what will be the rise of the medieval Russia.
And then the Normans, I don't even honestly know which part of Scandinavia the Normans came from.
Probably Norway.
Okay.
It's probably a good guess.
Yeah. Norsemen.
They were originally Norwegian adventurers led by a chieftain by the name of Rolf, although he's known in the French chronicles as Rollo. And the French king decides, instead of trying to beat these guys off, I'll just bribe them to leave us alone. So they give Rolf a large swath of territory facing onto the English Channel, which becomes known as the Land of the Norsemen, or Normandy.
Yeah.
And Norman knights, as I explain in the book, we talk about the Norman achievements and conquests, not just in England, of course, with the most famous, you know, William the Conqueror, but also the conquests in Italy and Sicily, and eventually linking up with the Crusades in the Holy Land.
Yeah, the Normans ruled at least Sicily for hundreds of years, right?
Yeah, they did. And they really established Italy. They ended the Muslim domination of southern Italy and Sicily. And they go from becoming sort of the disruptors for Western Christendom to becoming one of the mainstays of establishing the boundaries, firming up the boundaries of Western Christendom.
And we've mentioned the Danes who took over much of the British Isles and kind of blended their culture and blood with the native Anglo-Saxons.
Yes, and also you had, as I explained in that chapter on the Norman conquest of England, what you've got is a triangular struggle for power.
Right.
Because in addition to William the Conqueror, a Norman ruler, you've also got a Norwegian king.
Harald Hardrada.
Hardrada, who's come over thinking, hey, this is a throne that I should be able to pick up. I've got a good army. I've got a fair claim to the throne. And I've got an ally in the former king's dissolute brother. And then you've got, of course, Harald, The king of the Anglo-Saxons.
Harold Godwinson, and we always think of him as the king of the Anglo-Saxons, but the truth is, I've actually, inspired by you and your book that I just read, I actually picked up off my shelf a biography of Canute. Man, the Harold himself, the Godwin family, I mean, they were basically Danes who had been raised to power by Canute.
That's right. I mean, what you could really say is that whole extraordinary episode of 1066, right, 1066 and all that, is really a triangular struggle between three different branches of the Viking legacy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Harold, whose mother was Danish, who spoke Old Norse just as fluently as he spoke Old English. You've got William the Conqueror, direct descendant of the Norman conquerors. Of Normandy and Viking conquerors of Normandy, and then you've got Harald Hardrada, who is a full fledged Viking king, and probably the last and the greatest of those formidable Viking chiefs.
And then just to recap, if you just move across the European continent, you have the Swedish becoming the Rus and founding Kiev. You have the Normans becoming a powerful force in the mainland and into the Mediterranean. And then you have the Danes basically defining England up until the Norman conquest. It's like and the Norwegians then, of course.
I was going to say, don't forget.
Yeah, we got to do something with Norwegians. So let's get to Iceland and Greenland.
Out to the west,
yeah.
Further and further out west. And this is why I think you can describe the Vikings as the precursors of globalization.
Yeah, because that's not it. Yeah, I mean, there's something weird about them, that's for sure.
Yeah, that is. And the seaward routes that they established, which began as conquest but then become routes of trade, become the foundations for the Atlantic system and also for European seaborne trade from that time, you could argue, almost to the present as well. And when you think about this, how ironic is it that you've got Viking adventurers who connect the old centers of Western civilization, first to Russia and then to America.
You are listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. We're speaking with Arthur Herman, author of The Viking Heart, How Scandinavians Conquered the World. When we come back from a short break, we're going to tackle Norse mythology. Along the way, we'll bump into Richard Wagner, Nazis, J.R.R. Tolkien, and the Disney Marvel Universe. Constant Wonder will be right back. Stay with us. Thanks for joining with us today on Constant Wonder. We're speaking with Arthur Herman, the author of The Viking Heart, How Scandinavians Conquered the World. I want to turn now to Norse mythology, which, like the Vikings in its own way, also conquered the world. This saga is going to take us from Wagner's Ring Cycle to Nazi ideology to J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings to the Marvel Universe film franchise. It's a wild ride. Buckle up. Arthur Herman, one of the things that you point out in your book is that Norse legends emphasize world building in a way that didn't really happen in the German knockoffs. You argue, in fact, that one reason that the German Nazis ultimately appropriated Norse legend is that their own equivalents were pretty weak.
Yeah, they did. I think I think it also was one of the things that speeded, shall we say, the conversion of the Germanic tribes to
Christianity. They had a thin
gruel of sort of, I mean, apart from, you know, certain pagan rites, it's a rather thin gruel in terms of myth or mythology, things that give life meaning, right? It gives your everyday life, connects it to more universal values. Whereas I think in many ways with the Vikings and Norse mythology, those cold winter nights, there's nothing to do but talk and to tell stories and to build and to weave a pattern of understanding of how the world works that connects ordinary life and the lives of everyone around you and family and so on to the larger meaning of the world, of the cosmos. And this is something that the Norse mythology and then the Icelandic saga writers who took time to write all this down, this is what they managed to achieve, and that makes it a kind of really, I think, one of the unique contributions to the history of world religion.
Yeah, and the Icelandic writers did this kind of weird combination of history and lore, and it's sometimes a little hard to disentangle, but there's a lot of actual history in those writings as well.
Oh, tremendous. Oh, very, very much so. But there's also a lot of myth and legend woven into the history. Defined as history also contains a lot of what we would consider based on insufficient evidence.
Yeah.
But it is, at the same time, what emerges from those Icelandic sagas is a worldview, which is kind of remarkable, Eric, because on the one hand, these were written by, about 200 years after the end of the Viking Age proper. So they're looking back to the past. It's written by scribes who were certainly Christian and who identified themselves with the mainstream of Christian civilization, Western civilization, and yet who take this kind of very interesting pride in their pagan past and in that Viking past and preserve it for us in their writings that I think gives them this kind of vibrancy and a sort of it makes them so readable today that one of the other things that I would hope that my book would do is, in addition to reading the book, is it will encourage people to take a look at the Icelandic sagas. There's a lot there that's really interesting.
Well, let me just follow up on that, because you spend a fair amount of time, I mean, in your book, you spend a fair amount of time talking about how Wagner and Nietzsche kind of appropriated Norse mythology and how that took an ugly turn. I was actually struck by the fact that Wagner's son-in-law was a flaming anti-Semite.
Yeah, that's right. Houston Stuart Chamberlain.
Yeah.
If you talk about him, there's more details in the first book I ever wrote, actually, which is called The Idea of Decline in Western History. And I go into much greater detail about the appropriation of Norse myth and integration into race theory in the later 19th century. But the important thing to bear in mind is that this was the co-optation of Norse myth into these grand racist theories of civilization and race and master race. As I explain at the end of the book with the writer J.R. Tolkien, who is steeped in Norse literature as well as Old English literature, what he really wanted to do with his Lord of the Rings trilogy was to take up Norse myth as it really was, as a real set of documents and a real story, inspiring story of myth and legend, and to take it away from the Nazis and to restore it to its true universal meaning.
Yeah. Now, to be fair, there's an element of Christianization. It's very subtle, but what Tolkien does is, if not overtly Christianize it, at least he creates a sense of hope and redemption that isn't really in the original traditions.
Not so much. Although, of course, as Christian writers themselves, the Icelandic poets, the skaldas, as they're called, did incorporate some of that Christian, element of redemption, plays a big part in their view about cosmogony. It's indelibly imprinted there in it. But yes, he does. And of course, it's not a retelling of Norse myth. It's an incorporation of some of its universal themes into a much broader mythic narrative, which includes other types of elements borrowed from Arthurian legend and from all the other sources.
But the richness of it is, and you were getting at this earlier, is it's so readable and accessible and immediate today.
Really is.
And that's why Marvel can make bank on it.
That's right. They can, exactly. Which they're not going to do with other medieval literature. I was originally trained as a medievalist. That was my original background and interest as an undergraduate. And I'd spent a lot of time reading medieval literature. I worked my way through the Song of Roland in Old French. Eric, I used to have dreams in Old French. I worked my way through, I learned Middle High German so I could work on Parsifal and the German epics and the Romance of the Rose and Old English and Beowulf. But in the end, none of it compares to the amazing relevance and immediateness of those Norse sagas. They're an extraordinary chapter in Western literature, I would say in world literature. in many ways that I really hope readers, after they finish my book, will want to pick up and explore for themselves.
Yeah. One observation, Wagner, when he picks up the ring, which comes right, the ring of power, which both Tolkien and Wagner borrow, Wagner's hero is about to use the ring for power when he gets thwarted and disaster occurs and the end of, you know, the Twilight of the Gods kicks in. But Tolkien's hero is about to destroy the Ring of Power.
That's right.
When you look at history, you look at Tolkien writing in 1940, he expressed some extreme frustration, which you quote in the book about the co-optation, right?
Yeah, he does. Yeah. And of course, you just pointed to it. The difference is a difference of a modern mindset influenced by Christianity. There's no doubt. Versus the earlier insight. And as you say, Tolkien's hero, right, is there to renounce power, to destroy it, because a realization that this is a power that's too much. It's too much for one person or any person to hold. Whereas a Viking chieftain would say, "Are you crazy?
Yeah.
Give me that ring." No, yeah. And of course, that's the tragedy. That's the underlying tragedy behind, in a way in which the Tolkien story is not a tragedy. Right? There's a happy ending. Power is broken. Mordor is destroyed. The tragedy in Norse myth, which I have to say Wagner captured, is that the striving for power becomes and the grasp for it becomes the main story and the destruction that it brings to our heroes. Sigurd in the original Norse saga, Siegfried in the Wagner operas. They're destroyed by the search for power, which is a natural human impulse and a natural Viking impulse.
Yeah, but I mean, what the interpreters, you know, when Wagner was taken, I say taken in a dark turn. I'm not sure that he was never at that point, but when the anti-Semites and the German nationalists embraced it, I mean, they weren't taking the lesson that the pursuit of power leads to, you know, extinction.
No, not at all. Not in the slightest degree.
Yeah. In fact, Nietzsche is gonna turn power into like the only virtue.
That's right. The will to power.
Yeah.
It becomes the key for what it is that is the unique human quality, and it's the one that religion, including Christianity, tries to suppress.
Yeah.
Because the elites realize that to unleash that power signalizes their doom. And that's pretty much how the Wagner ring cycle comes to be interpreted here is that the old gods, the old order tried to suppress that power, but now the new master race will be able to grab it. Yeah. It's a view that would be incomprehensible and repulsive to a J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yes.
And one of the reasons why he does.
Yeah, but it's
totally.
Such a profound conflict. Well, we're out of time for this conversation, so what we're going to have to do, as I mentioned, is we're going to come back and talk about the rise of the modern Scandinavian and see if we can square these circles. We didn't quite get to some of the more jarring elements of Viking tradition, so maybe when we get back together, what we'll do is we'll start with that and then see how we can make that transition to Christianity and modernity.
But, Eric, I'd be happy to do it.
All right. Well, this is, I think I'm really looking forward to it. This is really fascinating material. My son is a big Marvel fan, and he's...
No kidding.
He's been, they have that Loki thing going on.
Yes.
And he would get up in the middle of the night to watch Loki right when it was released. And I was talking to him just the other day. I was saying, Ben, you need to get into the real stuff here.
definitely. No, I mean, and as you know from that last chapter of the book is about the Viking art, is about how those same themes resonate with all of us and resonate as part of, and the transference of those mythic themes into the world of superheroes and the Marvel comic heroes. I don't see it at all as a degradation. I see it as that's precisely why they continue to live.
So we've been speaking with Arthur Herman, who is the author, among other books, of The Viking Heart, How Scandinavians Conquered the World. He is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, and we're going to pick up with another conversation with him very soon on the Christianization and modernization of the Scandinavian Viking heart. Arthur, thanks for being with us.
It's been a pleasure, Eric.
Next on Constant Wonder, think of the long, cold winter nights way up north, Vikings telling each other stories to pass the time, those unequaled Norse legends, no doubt. But it appears they may also have spent a fair amount of time playing board games. Some potential evidence for this has shown up recently on Lindisfarne Island. We're going to tell that story next. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Just barely off the coast of England on the east, a little below the Scottish border, there's a tiny island, Lindisfarne by name. Lindisfarne has a dubious distinction in history because in 793, Vikings sacked the monastery there. And that event is now understood to be the beginning of the Viking scourge that for the next 200 years would traumatize the residents of Britain. Not long ago, a volunteer archaeology team was digging there and found some evidence that may point to the idea that Vikings were not all plunder and no play. I got the story from David Petz, a professor of archaeology at Durham University and a member of the Institute of Medieval and Early Modern Studies. We got going in our conversation with me learning a little bit more about this island of Lindisfarne that was so pivotal to a clash of European cultures.
Well, Lindisfarne, or Holy Island, it's a small island off the northeast coast of England. It's about 15 miles south of the border between England and Scotland. And what makes it very special is it's a tidal island. So when the tide is in, you're isolated there. It's a proper island. But when the tide comes out, people can get on and off by driving over a causeway, literally driving across the seabed onto the island. And it's particularly important for us in Britain as a very important early medieval religious site, an early Christian monastery.
And so when it's early, are you talking about early enough that no records were kept of the earliest Christians there? Or are we talking about people arriving there, founding a monastery, and writing about it all the while?
Yeah, it was founded in the 7th century, and we have some good documents recording how it was set up. It was set up by one of the kings of Northumbria, who had been in exile in Scotland, and when he became king, he came back over to Northumbria, which is this northeastern side of England, and he set up a monastery, and the famous Anglo-Saxon historian, the Venerable Bede, writes about how it was set up.
So there has been more or less a continuous written history of the place since its founding as a monastery.
Yeah, the level of detail varies. Obviously, with the earlier stuff, it can be a little bit schematic. And then as we get into the later medieval period, we have much more details. We have accounts, literal and financial accounts surviving and that kind of thing. And so, yes, but we have a lovely documentary record all the way through to the 16th century when the monastery was finally abolished.
Now, are there standing structures from the first founding days, or are those long gone?
Right, the buildings from the earlier monastery are long gone. There may be possibly little fragments in one of the churches, but there are ruins. The ruins date from the kind of 11th and 12th century onwards. So if you visit it today, you'll see remains of a ruined monastery. But the religious site myself and Dick Benches are interested in lies beneath the ground.
Now let's get to the business at hand, which has to do with a recent find of a little object, no bigger than, fill me in.
Yeah, it's a small glass object. It's I think it's about 2 centimeters by 2 centimeters. It's a beautiful, it's a little round playing piece, we think it is. It's made of very, very dark blue glass, so almost black, with beautiful swirls of white glass on it, and four little bubbles, literally a couple of millimeters diameter, kind of crowning it. And as I said, we think this is an early medieval playing piece.
So I have a picture of it here, and I'm looking at it. It almost looks like a confection, but it's solid glass.
Absolutely, yeah. You're not the first person to suggest that. It looks very, very eatable.
Yeah, and the blue color is just exquisite. For a blue of that dark, deep color to survive all these years, I guess out of the way of sunlight, maybe that helped preserve it. Do we know what the blue is?
Yeah, we started to do a little bit of scientific analysis on it, and the blue color comes from the mineral cobalt, which was used in glass of the early medieval period to get this, yeah, this lovely, lovely blue color, which is very common in glass objects like this back then.
So let's talk a little bit about this crowd business and Dig Ventures and their participation here. Was it just some citizen volunteering who showed up who happened to say, hey, I found something?
Well, basically, we've been running the project together for, I think this is about our fourth season, and we have about kind of 20, 25 people who work with the community members who work with the project. And yes, it was one of them who actually found it. It's always the way. It's the volunteers who find the good stuff, the trained archaeologists who are normally sitting there doing the paperwork. And yes, they found this beautiful little object. It was really rather pleasing.
So the site, let's narrow it down from the island all the way down to the actual location. Was it just sort of a random spot on the island, or do we know that there was some kind of a living quarters or a chapel or something? Where was this?
Right. Well, I think the important thing to understand is that these early medieval monasteries were very, very big, particularly Lindisfarne, which was one of the most important monasteries in early medieval Britain. So the monastery itself probably now underlies most of the village of Holy Island. When we started the project, we did what's called geophysical survey, which is a way of looking underneath the ground to get a sense of where there's disturbances. And there's a large open area to the east of the surviving ruins where there's clearly remains to be looked at. And when we started the project, we opened up a trench, and the first thing we found was human bone. We'd come down onto a cemetery, and we did some carbon-14 dating, the way of dating the bone, and that showed us clearly that this cemetery was of early medieval date. We also found some grave markers of the same period. And the little playing piece seems to come from somewhere in what comes from that cemetery area. We don't think it's from a grave. We think it's more likely it's someone had kind of dropped it, or it had been kind of from a disturbed context. But it was found by somebody doing a little bit of light troweling, and out it pops.
So somebody was visiting the cemetery. This is my imagination speaking. Somebody was visiting the cemetery, and they had a little bauble in their pocket. There's a hole in the pocket, and it slipped away.
It could well have been something like that. I mean, somewhere like Lindisfarne, there's a lot of people coming in and out, even in the early medieval period. Also, over time, things get moved around in the soil. The fields have been ploughed throughout the medieval period. So things may well have kind of moved laterally across the field. So they may not necessarily have been lost in the cemetery, but certainly that's where it eventually emerged.
So this object is so particular in its detail, and it's clearly ornamental. You say that it's conjectured to have been some kind of a game piece for some kind of a game. Are there comparable finds elsewhere that look like this? Is there any way to compare this with other, chess pieces or board game pieces?
Yeah, there's actually quite a lot of surviving board game and game pieces from the early Middle Ages. These were a kind of an aristocratic leisure thing, and so they've been found in things like Viking boat burials. They've been found associated with trading sites. So the simplest ones are just little simple bone or stone counters, but there's a smaller subgroup of these much nicer glass ones. And certainly I was actually just looking at some photos yesterday of some very similar looking ones made out of lead, which come from an important Viking site in England. So, yeah, they seem to sit within this kind of wider range of board playing pieces from this period.
So now you've used the word Viking, I think, for the first time in our conversation. And up to this point, we've been talking about a Northumbrian king, and I don't know where the Vikings enter the picture here. Are you saying that Vikings came to Lindisfarne?
Yes, we know the Vikings came to Lindisfarne. It's one of the places which is probably the first place to be attacked by Vikings in Britain. At the end of the 8th century, there's a notorious Viking raid on the island. The Vikings, obviously, are attracted by the monasteries because they're centres of wealth. So it's very well known as one somewhere which was raided by the Vikings. And if you're listeners who don't know much about the kind of the medieval history in England, what happens is the Vikings raid in the early to mid 9th century, and increasingly, rather than just having hit and run raids, after a while the armies start overwintering in Britain rather than going back to Scandinavia, and eventually in the 9th and 10th century you actually get quite substantial Viking settlements, particularly in the north of England. Now, whether this object was specifically Viking, we can't hand on heart say, but certainly it's the Vikings and the Anglo-Saxons, although we tend to think of them as being kind of pitted against each other, they actually shared quite a lot of their kind of cultural world. They traded with each other as well as raided. So it's part of that wider kind of cultural activities which we might expect both Vikings and Anglo-Saxon aristocrats to indulge in.
So back to the comparative question of, are there other playing pieces like this found elsewhere? Are you saying that the similar pieces or comparable pieces are limited to England, Scotland, or in Scandinavia or elsewhere on the European continent? Can you find such pieces?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you said, we have kind of English and Scottish examples, but they're found in Scandinavia, certainly some of the big Scandinavian sites, such as Birka, which is a kind of near modern-day Stockholm. It's a major Viking trading site. There's a site called Dorstadt in the Netherlands, which again is a major trading site, which would have had both Vikings and Anglo-Saxons and Frisians and all sorts of people coming into and exchanging goods. So yeah, so there's this kind of shared cultural repertoire of objects which kind of transcended individual ethnic groups and, you know, was used by the Vikings and the Anglo-Saxons and the Frisians and the Franks and the Carignans. There's lots of people using these kind of objects.
So now I'm trying to think through the potential that somebody coming from Scandinavia, a raider perhaps, would bring along game pieces. I don't know if you play the game on the ship on the way over, or you wait till you arrive, or maybe it's the monks there at Lindisfarne who are native to the area. And then I'm thinking about, do the monks really have leisure time to just play games, to play board games? You know, early Christians and their piety, their devotional practices, and then a little bit of gaming on the side?
Well, we tend to think of these, traditionally, people tend to think of these early monastic sites as being quite isolated, quite austere. And certainly there is that element to kind of Anglo-Saxon Christianity. But also, somewhere like Lindisfarne, it would have been one of the biggest population centres. This is a world without towns in northern Britain, so it probably would have been the largest population in the surrounding area. It was a centre for trade. These monks, certainly the abbots, these were equivalent to secular aristocrats. These are incredibly important people, socially and politically, as well as religiously. So they would have attracted visitors. And we know that actually, in some cases, if you're an important aristocrat or even a king, you might retire. And actually, in your retirement, you might go and spend your life, your final years, in a monastery. So we know there's at least one Northumbrian king who retires to Lindisfarne after he's finished his day's ruling. He obviously wants a peaceful end to his life. And actually, he certainly seems to be interested in having a reasonably leisurely life, because one of the things we know about this king is that just before he comes to Lindisfarne as a monk, he gives the monks permission to drink wine. We know Cuthbert was, but equally I think it's pretty clear that there are certainly some individuals who are looking to live a slightly more luxurious lifestyle.
Did you happen to be right there? Were you on the site at the time this was found?
No, it's really embarrassing. I'm on site almost all the time. There's one day I had to be off site to go to a meeting at work down in Durham, which is about, I don't know, 70 miles away, and I was literally just in the car park of the supermarket, and I got a text from one of my colleagues just sending through a picture of this object. And I can remember very clearly, pouring down of rain. I was standing outside the supermarket, trying to see what this kind of picture was, which had been sent to me on the phone. And then lo and behold, I mean, obviously the first photo I saw, it was just out the ground. It was covered in mud, but straight away I could see it was something which is really rather nice.
Yeah, that story right there tells enough about the excitement, because if it's pouring rain and people are digging and then you're getting sent this picture of the thing, there was immediate recognition that we're on to something here. This is important.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, although people weren't immediately sure quite what it was clear, those of you have seen a picture, it's this exquisite little object. And I think, even if you don't know precisely what it is, intuitively, it's such a nice item. And I think, importantly, the early medieval period, our site doesn't produce an awful lot of objects. It's not like we're producing loads of pottery and brooches and things all the time. It's quite a kind of simple site in terms of the archaeology. So to find any objects is, you certainly get a thrill. But to find something which is so immediately aesthetically attractive was, we knew we were onto something good.
So last of all, a volunteer finds this. They're with Dig Ventures. You're collaborating with them, helping to guide them through this, documenting everything. Do you have a name for this thing? Is there a formal way of describing it now? Do you call it a Viking game piece? What do you call it?
We've been calling it an early medieval game piece because a lot of people, because certainly in Britain, the association between Lindisfarne and the Vikings is very strong, and we've been trying to stop people getting too fixated on the Viking aspect. So we've just been calling it the Lindisfarne playing piece.
David Petz, fascinating tale, and it sounds like it's really kind of nice to think that you would invite volunteers to come and participate. Do you lean on them? Do you rely on them?
Yeah, I mean, the whole community volunteer aspect, which has been brought to the project by my collaborators at Dig Ventures, is incredibly important. They provide the bulk of the workforce. Obviously, there's myself and the Dig Ventures staff and my students. But they're absolutely crucial in terms of the funding and actually being out there on site. They're very central. They're a key part of the team.
David, just such a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Absolute pleasure to talk to you.
David Petz is from the Department of Archaeology at Durham University and head of the dig team at the Holy Island of Lindisfarne. We're going to cap off the week now, here at Constant Wonder at least, with a quick, quirky look at an alternative way to bury the dead. Instead of manicured golf course-like terrain, Trevor Crean of Heritage Gardens in Vancouver, Canada, wants to offer people wildflowers and vine-ripe tomatoes when they go to visit the graves of their loved ones.
In our early days, we had an open house shortly after we opened, and we had about 36 people from around the area and a couple of our friends come out, and we had a little questionnaire out on the table asking, every other cemetery you go to in town is kind of manicured like a golf course. Here, we want to focus on environmental friendly initiatives. And so, do you want to see us trim the place up like a golf course, or do you want to see us incorporate nature as best as we can? 100% of people said, work with nature, not against it. So what we realized is, I don't know about the focus where you are, but up here we're bombarded all of the time about the how pesticides and chemicals and agriculture is wiping out our pollinating insects. And so we thought, okay, first thing we can start with is let's get some beehives out here. And when you mow a lawn, you are leaving just the short grass. You're taking off all the weed tops. It's dandelions that the insects use for pollinating. It's clover that they're looking for. And so when you mow the lawn, you've just got an ocean of empty useless nutrition for pollinators, so they got to go elsewhere. So what we've done is the unused areas of our cemetery, we mow around them, like near the roadside, so it looks organized. But then the center in the spring and summer, we let the middle of the field just grow wild. We hit it with bags of wildflower seeds, and they just pop out with all sorts of colors, and they're very handy for the pollinating insects. And that, in turn, brings birds, and that, in turn, brings other animals. So we end up here, it's kind of like the opening scene of Bambi for a good 3 months a year. And then we sustainability is, it takes more forms than just being eco-friendly. And so we really believe that if we're going to be, if we're going to base our operation on sustainability, we have to do more than the eco-friendly. And for us, that means that we had to keep our place affordable so that it was accessible to families. And the other thing is that we had to look at how can we give back to the community. And so we already knew, our office right now on the site is a farmhouse that was built by the previous owner. And so that's what we've been using for offices. But there's not any space here to have a gathering or celebration service. And so we know that we'll need a building one day. And so we've earmarked a beautiful half acre for that development, except it's probably not in the works for 3 to 5 years. And so I was speaking with my uncle, who is a farmer from Eastern Canada, and he moved out here a few years ago for a nicer climate. And I said, "Hey, Stan, how would you feel about being the caretaker at the cemetery?" And he said, "Oh, man, that would be awesome. I get to live in that house." I said, "Yeah, there's one condition. We're gonna need a farm." And so he's out there on that building site where it's, right now it's just a nice open lawn, and he began to start growing veggies. And in the early days, we would just give them to friends, like visitors and families that we had served. And it's a pleasant surprise. It's definitely unexpected. But what we're thinking is, like, we need to build connection with people, and we wanted to provide a setting that people would feel comfortable returning to. Like, we wanted to be a lot more than just that sad day of the funeral. We want them to want to come back and say, "Oh my gosh, look at the beehives, there's more of them this year," or, "Hey, maybe we're going to see a deer this time out at the cemetery," or, "Hey, if I come in June, I might leave with a bag of tomatoes and some zucchinis." So it makes us approachable, it makes it relatable, and that is a huge part of finding peace in laying a loved one to rest.
Well, don't you think this is more than just the window dressing of helping people along with their feelings? You're actually merging farmland with a burial plot.
Yes, in a sense we are.
Trevor Crean of Heritage Gardens in Vancouver, Canada. What do you think of that idea? Tomatoes fresh from the cemetery. I could get on board with that, actually. On Monday, we'd love to have you join with us. Deborah Madison has earned high praise for her book, Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone. So why would this respected writer of a vegetarian cookbook shy away from the label vegetarian? It's her calling card, after all. We'll find out from her this Monday. Join with us for Constant Wonder then. I'm Marcus Smith. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.